Hello, everyone, and welcome to another America's Conservative Podcast. I am your host, Ed Densel. It's Tuesday. It's tournament week here in the Densel apartment in Deer Beach, Florida. I got a big tournament coming up this weekend. Looking forward to it. Going to be playing against a lot of players who are half my age, if not younger. I'm 46 years old. I'm really looking forward to it. I think I'm going to be fairly competitive. So, just have to compete against myself, although, like I said, I am very competitive, and if I get my butt kicked too badly, I will take it personally. So I got to get out and throw a little bit today, and then probably I will go out and throw on Friday, and that'll be that, and I'll have to be ready for Saturday and Sunday. Speaking of sports, I saw that Dale Earnhardt Jr. is going to be retiring after this NASCAR season. I used to be a huge NASCAR guy, but I have not watched a race in a long time. Other things to do, my interests have gone elsewhere. My favorite driver, Mark Martin, retired several years ago. And I mean, he retired, then he came back and ran a partial schedule, and I would make it a point to watch those races where he was driving. But once he was done for good, I kind of said the heck with it. And it seems that NASCAR's popularity has dropped. I'm not sure what's going on there. Seemed like it rose as the economy did in the mid-2000s, and then the economy tanked. And as the economy has come back 0.1% by 0.1%, it seems that NASCAR's ratings and the popularity and everything just hasn't returned. And it still doesn't seem to me like 10 years later they've figured that out. So they have, I guess, popular drivers. And, of course, Jimmy Johnson and, of course, Jeff Gordon retired. One was the year before last. But Jimmy Johnson's still out there. And a lot of other popular drivers still compete. I don't know. I'm just not totally sure. Me, I can tell you for me personally, the reason I don't watch is my favorite driver retired. For other people, I'm going to guess that there are other reasons. I don't know. But I have to, you know, it seems that little E, Dale Earnhardt Jr., is a good guy. He's won a lot of races, but I think in the end, if he's retiring after this year, I think that he underachieved. There were high expectations for him, but the truth is that he's never won a NASCAR championship. In the time that he has been racing, Jimmy Johnson has won seven of them. Seven of them. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. would have access to as much knowledge and expertise, engineering advancements, as much as anybody else in the sport, easily. And still, he's won the Daytona 500. Like I said, he's won a bunch of races, but still, he's never been able to win a championship. And I think that that will always be a ding on his career. The question is he a Hall of Famer? I guess he will be, end up being one, just because of who he is, but I don't even think he's won as many races as Mark Martin has. And Mark Martin, of course, never won a championship, but he won a lot of races. He won a lot of record races in the Nationwide Series, the tier right under the main guys. He had a record for many, many years about winning races there. He did a lot. Mark Martin did a lot in the sport, won a lot of races, came out of nowhere to do it, and he's now in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. To me, Dale Earnhardt Jr. has done less in the sport than Mark Martin has. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, he's going to get in, but if Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s last name wasn't Earnhardt, would he get in? That's a very, very interesting question. And I don't think it should be enough that he was, you know, he's been the most popular driver for the last 10 years. That shouldn't factor into whether a driver makes it into the Hall of Fame or not. It certainly doesn't factor in the NFL Hall of Fame or the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. It doesn't matter how popular a player is. If the person, the player doesn't have the stats, he doesn't get in. Doesn't get in. So we're just going to have to see. It's going to be, we'll see how many years it takes for Dale Earnhardt Jr. to get in there, and I will be paying attention to what writers have to say about his legacy and what he meant to the sport, and if he left, a mark on it, a good mark on it, and whether his achievements are worthy of being in the Hall of Fame. It's going to be very interesting to follow that, even though I don't follow NASCAR that much anymore. So let's get to the show. I want to start off with this piece of news. Bill O'Reilly is now in the podcasting business. I want to extend a personal welcome to Bill O'Reilly. He started podcasting yesterday, and boy, is he in for a treat. And I think that everybody is going to find out very quickly about his popularity and how popular people think he is, or what we have been told regarding his popularity on Fox News. It's going to be very, very interesting. I welcome him, and he's going to find out that podcasting is a little bit of a grind no matter who you are. Podcasting is a way for regular people like myself to compete and get the attention of the same people who are more well-known and are making a lot of money doing political talk. Because if you look at, for example, iTunes, and you go to the news and politics section, what you're going to see is a mixture of well-known people who have popular shows with a mixture of a bunch of people who you don't know who have popular shows. And in that way, the competition ground is leveled. Everybody just has a computer and a microphone. They have access to the same information, the same technology, and it all comes down to how well do you do your craft? Bill O'Reilly doesn't have Fox News advertising for him anymore. And he doesn't have all of those sponsors. Of course, a lot of them deserted him after those allegations all came out, and they found out all this money that had to be paid to these women over the years that was kind of hushed up. He isn't going to have the cachet, the power of that 8 o'clock hour on Fox News, where the lead-in, watch Bill O'Reilly at 8 o'clock, and he's just not on there anymore. He's going to have to rely on himself, his own abilities, his own advertising abilities, his own talents. And if you'll remember, I think a lot of people forget about this, he had a radio show at one time. It was when I lived in Las Vegas. It seems like it was yesterday, but it was when I lived in Las Vegas, and that's been over 5.5 years now. And he tried to compete against Rush Limbaugh, and it went nowhere. It absolutely went nowhere. And so what's going to happen with this? Here's what I know. I'm pretty sure that I think that O'Reilly's show, how many viewers was it allegedly getting per night? 3 million viewers or anything? He's not going to smell. He will not smell 1/10 of that number in downloads and plays and the ways that you gauge popularity on the internet. He is not going to smell that number. It won't be half. It won't be 1/4. And he's going to learn the economics of podcasting very, very quickly. On top of the fact that maybe his brand is damaged a little bit as it is as well. But there's something else to this. And this is something that I mentioned, I believe, last week regarding Fox News in their age demographic. And the problem that I think that Fox News has is that their viewers are dying. And they have to rely on new viewers to keep up the ratings that Fox News continues to get. It's a high turnover demographic that Fox News is in. People start listening in their 60s and then they die in their 70s. So they have that viewer for about 10 years, 10, 12, 13 years. That's it. So once that person checks out at, say, 75, they need like a 62-year-old to start watching or their numbers go down. Whereas a kind of channel that has a wider demographic that appeals to 30-year-olds to 60-year-olds, you can afford to have some drop-offs and things like that, because the time that that person is watching that channel or listening or whatever is a lot longer. And it's easier to keep those people. And those people aren't dying as quickly. So it's an interesting phenomenon. And then, you know, to make money in that demographic, if you have a wider demographic, a wider age range, say 30 to 65, it's a lot easier to get out of 3 million to 4 million people out of a demographic of 30 to 65 than it is to get out of a demographic that's only 13 years wide. And I think that Fox News is finally starting to realize this. So that's part of it. And getting back to Bill O'Reilly, the average age of a person who was watching his show couldn't have been any different than the average age for a person who watches Fox News overall, well into their 60s. Well, as a guy who's been podcasting for a long time and also has another program that's a podcast, most of your 60-year-olds have no idea what a podcast even is. Most. There are obviously some very tech-savvy people in their 60s and 70s, and I love every one of them. But how many of those people that have been watching Bill O'Reilly over the years are then going to say, oh, Bill O'Reilly has a podcast out? What's that? What's that? I've never heard of that. Well, oh, that's what it is. Well, how do I get it? Well, they have to find out that they have to get a subscription, or they have to sign up for iTunes, or have they signed up for Podomatic, and it's going to be down sent in their email. It's a lot of work. And I will say, even as a podcaster, I still believe that the way that our programs get to people can be better. There's a lot of hoops to jump through, even all of these years later, even though podcasting has been around for at least 10 years. I think it could still be easier than it is. So those 60, 70-year-olds who've been loving Bill O'Reilly all these years, if they find out that he's podcasting, they're going to have to ask themselves a serious question. Do I really want to get into this at my age? So that's why I also believe that Bill O'Reilly is going to find out very quickly that those numbers that he was getting on the O'Reilly Factor are going to be impossible to get podcasting. For a variety of reasons, given that who his demographic was, given that other people were advertising for him and all of it put together. And I wonder what that's going to do for his ego, which is huge. We'll just have to see. Why do I think that a year from now, Bill O'Reilly won't be podcasting at all? Because he's going to figure out it's just too much dang work for a guy like him, especially being that he's being paid $25 million to go away from Fox News. That's a suspicion that I have. We'll just have to see. But I welcome to the world of podcasting, and we'll see if he can do, he can do the hard work that goes along with this, in contrast to what he was doing on his show, that where I think that most of the people behind the scenes were doing the work and he was just getting out there and saying stuff. Because I know that's what he did with his books, them all being ghostwritten and him having very, very little to do with any of it. Trust me, as an author, I know. So there's that. But welcome, Bill O'Reilly. Let's move on to something else. You know, I was talking to my, I mentioned him so much, my friend Dave. We were talking. Well, I have to say that I was doing most of the talking, most of the typing anyway, regarding North Korea. And he has some particular concerns about North Korea and China that are private that I'm not going to go into here. But he and I were, as we do on a lot of topics, we were having a political discussion regarding it. And, you know, it gave me an opportunity to really play through the scenarios and type some things out and read what I wrote to try to assemble my thoughts, because I've talked a lot about North Korea recently. And I think that there's still a lot more to say. There's also another point that I'd like to make regarding this before I really get into some more of these details. That this does seem to be a topic that is catching a lot of people's attention who I think normally aren't that engaged in politics. I'm seeing it on my Facebook feed, for example. Yes, I do have people that are talking politics all the time, both right-wing and left-wing politics. People who talk about how Trump isn't their president, and then people who all they do is talk about how great Trump is, and there's a little bit of in-between. So I know who those people are. I could tell you their names right now. Of course, I'm not going to say them. But what I'm seeing are a lot of people who, to my knowledge and my memory, have never brought up politics at all, but suddenly they are mentioning North Korea. This seems to be a topic that has broken outside the policy wonk, the political wonks out there. It's broken through that bubble into people who are just casually catching the news every day. Probably people who maybe have never even thought about North Korea. Maybe they understand what it is. They understand that it's different from South Korea. Maybe they've even seen that map that was taken at night from a satellite, all these lights on in South Korea, no lights on in North Korea except to Kim Jong-un, or maybe at that time Kim Jong-il's palace. They might know that, but even with that, who knows? But it seems that they are now paying attention to what is going on. And I'm not sure if it's because of the hype. Is it hype that is causing these people to suddenly get engaged? Or is it because this is actually a really, really serious situation? And this was kind of the conversation. This was the theme of the conversation I had with Dave, and it allowed me to speak out on some things. I don't know how serious it is at this second. I don't know. I don't know that North Korea has done anything different. Let's just pick a time frame in the last month than it is done in the last 10 years or 20 years. I don't know if their behavior has changed. We have to most people don't realize it wasn't so long ago that North Korea sunk a South Korean naval ship, a North Korean submarine or something like that. They sunk a South Korean military vessel, like a destroyer or a frigate or something like that. And of course, people got killed, and we didn't do much. And people died. The rest of the world, we did not do a lot. There might have been some sanctions. I couldn't even tell you what they are now. But there was certainly no retribution. There was certainly nothing of South Korea striking back and sinking some North Korean ship or anything like that. There was no retribution. So, you know, there hasn't been any sinking of any ships. North Korea bombed a jetliner not long before South Korea held the Summer Olympics back in 1988, something that most people probably have forgotten. Me, I don't forget it because I'm a total airplane, you know, jet crash geek. But they did that to try to intimidate you know, to try to make people not want to go to South Korea for the Olympics. Of course, that failed. So it's not like North Korea is bombing any jets. There are no jets falling out of the sky because of North Korea. Yes, they've set off allegedly a nuclear test recently. They've been doing that for years. They've shot missiles off into the water off the east coast of North Korea. They've been doing that for years. So their behavior hasn't changed. Now, maybe, yes, okay, assassinating the half-brother of Kim Jong-un, that's kind of strange. But for years, North Korean agents have been going into South Korea, have been going into Japan, and kidnapping people and taking them to North Korea. That happens. That's been going on for decades. So even the assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother is not strange for what North Korea does. That's just what it does. So their behavior hasn't changed. What's changed is it seems that, in particular, the United States is taking a different attitude toward it now. So that is what's made it serious. It's not that North Korea's behavior has changed, that they've gotten more provocative. It's that we as the United States have gotten more provocative. And I think that matters. I think it matters. And so we have to keep it in context. You know, anybody who may tell you, maybe there's a straw man argument, but I'm just saying this. If anybody in any conversation you get into says, well, you know, the reason we're doing that is because North Korea, you know, the reason Trump's finally, you know, standing up to those guys is because North Korea has just gone too far. And you simply ask them, what is North Korea doing now that it hasn't done in the last 30 years? Nothing. Now, I'm not saying they should have gotten away with that stuff. They shouldn't. You know me. You know the longer that I go, the worse I think it's, the harder it's going to be to take care of that regime. But I think to these people who are suddenly straying into this story, like I said, those people who are not policy wonks or not political issue wonks, who aren't political geeks, their interpretation of it may be that North Korea is really going farther than it ever has, and it hasn't. And I think that this whole story needs to be framed in the right way before we continue discussing this. So there's that. The other part of this, and I think maybe the other reason that this has caught people's attention, is there's this going to be this meeting. All the senators are being called up to the White House tomorrow. I told Dave, I didn't even know you could fit 100 senators and their egos in the White House. I don't know if that's ever happened in my lifetime. And it has the feeling to me, if you want to use the word serious, is this serious? See, as a person, as a conservative, and I heard this, was it yesterday on the Commentary Magazine podcast? See, I don't believe that Donald Trump is a serious president. I don't believe that he is a serious person. And what I mean by that is, and there was a lot that was said during his campaign that kind of came off as, that the presidency is just a figurehead position. He's just going to hire the best people and they're going to do the work and all he has to do is sit back. That is somebody who isn't serious about being president, and that's not what the presidential position in the United States is. There are positions in other governments of the world, nation leaders, where the person is kind of a little bit of a figurehead, and the real work is maybe done by a prime minister or, you know, the legislative body, you know, some the parliament or the House of Commons or whatever else. And in some ways, some leaders of some countries are just really ambassadors. In the United States, that is certainly not the case. And so when I think about 100 senators being called up to the White House, I start getting the idea that Trump did that because he thinks that that's what a president does. That to seem serious, if I'm really a president, this is what a president would do, as if he saw that on an episode of The West Wing, a show that I never watched. Because really, if he wants to do something, if the United States leadership, the executive branch, the U.S. commander-in-chief, and the military members are worried about there's something going on that we as the United, the American people don't know about. There's some threat that is building that I don't know about, you don't know about, nobody but the in the most secret corners of intelligence the United States knows about. The last thing you want to do is call up 100 senators to the White House. You know why? Because not one of those men or women could keep their mouth shut. But I think that the Trump invites them out because to him, everything is a show. Everything is a spectacle. Everything is drama. Everything is hype. And so he thought, well, I'll call these people out. I'll get the senators to come out here and I'll be able to stand up on the stage and all these senators and I'll be talking to these people and look how presidential I look. I think that's the kind of guy he is. The problem is I don't think that a lot of people view him that way. So once again, this news of North Korea leaks its way into people who don't follow politics every day. They hear about 100 senators going to the White House and they start getting worried. Whereas to me, I almost feel like the opposite, that he's calling them up there kind of tells me that it's exactly the opposite, that it's not serious, that maybe some of this is posturing. And it's like him trying to appear presidential. Remember, the senators don't answer to him. Now, granted, I don't know if any senator would have the courage to, you know, resist going to the White House. Maybe in these days. We'll see how many of them show up. We'll see. We'll see. But they don't work for him. They don't answer to him. They are in a totally separate branch of government. And in actuality, they are equal to the president. Their branch is equal to his branch. And this kind of calling up that Donald Trump is doing reeks of him feeling that his branch is better than their branch. And it's not. They're all equal. And it feels to me like theater. He sits around. Wouldn't it be a great look? You know what would be great? We got this North Korea thing going on. We got the Carl Vinson over there. You know what would be great for publicity and get some great pictures? Get all the senators to come up to the White House. Oh my, wouldn't that be great? And he starts seeing like things from a movie. When in reality, that's really not what's done. And in fact, it's more common, of course, for the president to go down, to go over to the Capitol and stand there in front of the senators and the representatives than all of them to go up to the White House. This just feels like a bunch of hype and theater, but I think that is because people maybe don't understand that they feel something serious is going on. And I'm not sure it is. And this maybe gets into the strategy part of it. And I do want to talk about Kim Jong-un a little bit after the break. I just don't want to get into it right before the break. But I wonder if for all of you who listen to the show, you feel the same way. Is there something about this, what's going on, at least on the American side, that just doesn't quite feel right? There were all this tension and Trump calling China, talking to Japan and calling these senators, when really it doesn't seem that there's much different, there's anything new going on in North Korea that hasn't gone on before. I could understand if they'd sunk another South Korean ship. Or there had been some incursion into South Korea, like most people don't know that, what was it, late 70s, early 80s, was it before Ronald Reagan was elected? Man, I have to go back. But they had some, you know, the North Koreans came into South Korea and tried to assassinate the president of South Korea. Way, way back, over 30, easily over 30 years ago, over 35 years ago. Nothing like that has gone on. I know North Korea is dangerous, but what is exactly going on here? And I want to talk further about this after the break, the strategy part of it, and what I think is going through Kim Jong-un's mind after the break. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.
The voice of American conservatism, WRS Digital, Red State Talk Radio.
And we are back at America's Conservative Podcast. I want to continue to talk about North Korea. In fact, it may last the rest of the program. I want to move on into a couple different points here. First, regarding what we as American citizens maybe don't know about what's going on in North Korea. I'm sure that there are things behind the scenes that we don't know. Even though maybe from the outside, it seems like just another month in North Korea, with people dying, people starving, Kim Jong-un living high on the hog in his palace while everybody else suffers. Set off a nuclear device here, shoot some missiles into the water there, threatening this, threatening that, have a military parade. That's just your average month in North Korea. But let's just say that maybe there are some things going on behind the scenes. I have to believe that if there was truly danger involved here, here's a couple things that I think would be pertinent. I don't believe that the United States military, no matter who is president, this is totally outside the realm of Donald Trump. There is no way that the United States Navy would have put an entire carrier group that close to North Korea if it truly thought that North Korea had the ability to strike that group if Kim Jong-un lost his mind. I personally don't believe that. Those kinds of assets are not supposed to be, you know, to set up some sort of trap or something that, you know, you don't put those assets in harm's way. You know, the goal of an aircraft carrier is to be far, 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 far away and let the planes do the work. Let the jets do the work. Or let the submarines, which can't be detected, do the work. The aircraft carrier, all it is a floating runway. And so it's going to be kept far away because if something should happen and say the jets get off the ship and are headed toward North Korea and then the ship gets hit, jets need somewhere to land. Maybe they land in China. Maybe they land in Russia. Maybe they can make it to Japan or South Korea, whatever. But I don't believe the United States Navy, no matter how much Donald Trump personally may want it because he loves the theater and loves the spectacle, would put a carrier that close to somebody they thought that could really, or a country they thought could really, really harm it. It's one thing that you have to keep in mind. The United States Navy or the United States military does not believe in making easy targets, especially when our aircraft carriers are really the most powerful weapon on Earth. I guess you could say nuclear weapons are the most dangerous, but the weapon that is used the most, the aircraft carrier, it's definitely the most dangerous. And it has the greatest ability. So you're not going to put those things in harm's way. And of course, there's only so many of them. You know, you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of jets, but we only have how many aircraft carriers? So there's that. Also, if I thought that we were going to do something against North Korea, I think that we would have more than one carrier group in the area. Now, as far as we as American citizens know, there's only one carrier group in the area, and we're to believe that it's there now. Remember, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, we were told it was in the area, and it wasn't. I think it is. And that there's only one carrier that we know of in the area, and I think that it would leak out if there was another aircraft carrier that was also kind of secretly in the area, maybe not necessarily right beside the Carl Vincent, but, you know, maybe on the other side of Japan, on the east side of Japan, they can easily steam around there and get into position we needed. We haven't heard anything about that. So there's that. Now, here's what I know. Now, if we get two carriers in there, if it's Carl Vincent and some other carrier in the area, then I got to say, that seems like a lot of military hardware in that area. And yes, something is going to happen, I would say. But with just one aircraft carrier there, I don't think that we're going to try anything against North Korea, because it does have a lot of capabilities, has a huge army, has a lot of jets, has a lot of missiles. Whether these people that fly the jets are skilled, who knows? Who knows? Whether these missiles can hit anything, who knows? But I just don't think that the American military, especially the U.S. Navy, would take these chances with just one carrier if something were going to happen. So strategically, I think that all means something. Number one, I don't think that we put a carrier in harm's way, as it seems like we are doing. Two, that there aren't any other carriers in that vicinity that we know of tells me that this is just, we're just kind of keeping an eye on North Korea. This is not a prelude to something violent. We're just kind of saying, hey, we're over here. Hi. How you doing, Kim Jong-un? We know that you don't have the capability to really strike this carrier, even though you say that you can. But we're keeping an eye on, we want you to know we're right here. So I think that's what's going on here. Now, are we provoking Kim Jong-un? Is this something where we are being provocative and we might make Kim Jong-un do something that he normally wouldn't, he regularly wouldn't do, as crazy as he is? That's a tougher question. You know, is it the chicken or the egg? Kim Jong-un does something. We feel like we have to respond. We steam over there with a carrier group. Then he does something, let's say worse than what he already did. Did we provoke it, or was he going to do it anyway? Are we just supposed to let Kim Jong-un and North Korea do whatever they want, which is kind of the pattern that has happened over the last several, you know, few decades, not several, but few decades? Because, you know, we've gotten to the point where, you know, it's almost like a child. You know, if you aren't disciplining your child, you let the kid continue to get away with something, whatever that is. It doesn't have to be criminal, but just something. Little kid, 5 years old, has chocolate on his hands, and he just, you know, goes down the hallway putting his hands all over the walls and dirtying them all up and everything, and you never discipline him or anything, and just let him get away with it. And then one day, you decide you are going to discipline your child for doing that, and then he throws a tantrum. Well, the tantrum was caused by you. But even though you did the right thing, and you, the problem is that had you done this the first time, it would have been well out of the way, and the kid probably wouldn't have gotten into the habit. So the tantrum that he throws after the 10th time is a lot worse than after the first time, because by the 10th time, the kid starts thinking, well, I'm allowed to do this. I'm having fun with this. Isn't this cute? My mommy and my daddy never say anything to him. I must be allowed to do it. This is the situation we've got into North Korea, where if something does happen, I think the peacenik people of the world, the kooks, are going to say that we caused it. And I don't think that's the case. I think what's going on here, us keeping an eye on North Korea, is probably something that should have been done a while ago, if that's exactly what's going on. So I wouldn't say that we're provoking him. I think that he's finally, you know, knowing that, you know, he's seeing that, well, you know, new boss isn't the same as the old boss. And we're hoping, I think that the most of the world is hoping that Kim Jong-un and his people come to their senses and tone down what they're doing, I think. That's why I think that all this hype about, you know, the seriousness of everything else. I'm not sure that that is exactly the case. We'll just have to see. Just don't know. It's a wild card. I don't know. There's another part to this. See, this is very interesting. This kind of stuff is very interesting to me. You know, the problem that Kim Jong-un has is that no matter how delusional and godlike he thinks he is and how the people of North Korea treat him, he knows he's not a god. He knows that he is going to die. Kim Jong-un, I don't believe, is, you know, delusional. I don't believe he's like a paranoid schizophrenic or anything like that. I'm not convinced of that. I think he's just a guy with a lot of power. And dare I say it, there are probably millions, if not a billion people on the earth who were, if they were put into the same situation that Kim Jong-un was, being the son of a dictator, a billion people in the world would have grown up to be exactly like Kim Jong-un is. That's my opinion on human nature. So I don't see Kim Jong-un as being that unique regarding human nature. He's just unique when it comes to the kind of leader he is and how he is treated in his country. I think that, you know, a majority of people can get drunk with power. And who doesn't, what human doesn't like to be treated like a god and worshipped? So the way I look at Kim Jong-un is I don't believe he's just some crazy maniac, you know, some megalomaniac that we see in some movies like a James Bond villain or something like that. I don't believe he's like that. But he knows how the world works. And I think he knows that if something happens, he's not going to get out of this alive. See, the problem that Kim Jong-un is in, and this is the difference between himself leading North Korea and, let's say, some dictator who has run some banana republic in South America, is that Kim Jong-un and North Korea have threatened the world. They have killed people in other countries. You know, I already mentioned a few things, the bombing, these incursions into South Korea over the years. American military members have been killed in the DMZ over the years, although not recently. The sinking of a South Korean ship. And even though the North Korean people may not realize that all of this stuff has gone down, Kim Jong-un knows it's happened. And he knows that probably he might have to answer for everything that has happened before him, from his dad, from his grandfather. Because really, they are criminals. The millions of people that have died in North Korea since they took up shop in that country dwarfs anything that happened during the Nazi times, during the Holocaust, simply because it's been a lot longer. It's been like, you know, 60 years. In contrast, the Nazis were in power for about 12, 13. So it stands to reason North Korea is going to, you know, the leader's going to be, you know, more destructive than the Nazis were, simply because of time. But he has to know there's no way that he's going to get away with something like, you know, and this has happened in the past, where you had some dictator, some country, and other countries came to him and said, you know what? We're tired of you. We're sick of you. But we know that you can make it miserable for us. So how about this? We're going to allow you to leave the country. You're going to be able to live in exile. Everything's going to be fine. Nobody's going to try to kill you. You're going to be able to live out your days. But we're going to turn your country into something a little bit more friendly to the countries around it. Idi Amin? Idi Amin had this happen to him, running Uganda. He got off easy. He got off easy. That's not going to happen with Kim Jong-un. There is no way that the rest of the world would be happy with a situation where China worked out something with him where they said, you know what, Kim Jong-un, it's time for your reign to end. It's time for this craziness that's gone on in this country to end. But here's what we're going to do. You're going to step down. You're going to come to China. You're going to be able to have as many hookers and as much nice food and cars and everything, but you just aren't going to have any power anymore. We'll protect you. We'll put you up in a safe area and everything, but North Korea needs to change. We're worried about it. The United States is worried about it. We're worried that you're going to do something that we really don't want to see. The problem with that is there's no way the rest of the world could live with that. There's no way that South Korea would live with that. There's no way that Japan would live with that. There's no way that the United States would live with that. There's no way that the family members who have escaped North Korea could live with that, knowing their family members. Because if you don't know, people who escape North Korea, their families who stick around, they get executed. Furthermore, once Kim Jong-un stepped down, that would allow all the national press to get in there a lot easier to see what's been going on there. And it would probably be like at the end of World War II with the concentration camps and everything. There's no way that Kim Jong-un could get away with just living in a palace in another country for the rest of his life. And although his people don't know that, he knows that. He knows that. And that's a problem. That is a problem with all this. And so this is why I don't think this can end nicely. On the other hand, let's take another possibility. And I don't think that the United States would have a hand in this, although we might know that it's coming. Say the Chinese, let's just say, assassinate Kim Jong-un. They figure that, okay, well, we can't allow him to live in exile anywhere. And we surely can't straighten out North Korea with him being alive. So we have to get rid of him. We have to get rid of him. We have to get rid of his wife. We have to get rid of his family. So we're going to send a team in there, and we're going to take all of these people out. Well, that presents its own issues because that's like killing the leader of a cult. Remember, your average North Korean knows nothing about the rest of the world. Nothing. Zero. Your average person in East Germany in, let's say, the 1970s, or your average Russian in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, knew 1,000,000,000,000,000 times more about the rest of the world than your average North Korean does in the year 2017. So what do you think that's going to mean to them? Even if they hate the guy, even if they somehow intuitively know that, man, it doesn't seem like life should be this hard. Even if they don't know what goes on in South Korea or the United States or Japan. What do you think's going to happen when their beloved leader just disappears one day? And it's more than obvious that he was assassinated. I'm not saying we have to parade his body, you know, in the streets of Pyongyang. But it's obvious that he was assassinated. What do you think that's going to do to the people of that country? Now, I'm not saying they're necessarily enemies of the United States, but what kind of crisis is that going to commit? Start. And how would China deal with that? How would South Korea deal with that? How would we deal with that? How would Japan deal with that? How would Russia deal with that? It's hard to say. So it's hard to imagine a scenario where that happens as well. Because that also sounds like a lot of work. So you can't let Kim Jong-un live like a god the rest of his life in another country. And you can't kill him either. You can't assassinate him and try to keep the damage to an absolute minimum where there's no collateral damage. There aren't any jets flying. There aren't any missiles flying or anything like that. You just get some crack team in there, commandos, go in there, infiltrate the palace or whatever else, and kill Kim Jong-un, everybody, and, you know, just wipe their hands of it. You can't see that either. See, these are the problems that you start thinking about with all of this. And there are no easy solutions. And this is everything that I typed out to Dave last night as we were talking about this. That, you know, it could be that of all scenarios, of all realistic scenarios, Kim Jong-un living in exile and his family living in exile, him and his family being assassinated, or war, or something that, if there is going to be some sort of quote-unquote solution, it may just seem that war is, I'm not saying the best solution, it's the only solution. It's almost the only thing that makes sense, that you can really wrap your head around. That something happens, we get together with China and South Korea, and we go in, and it's going to be bloody, it's going to be ugly. But something that is gradual like that, there's 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 7 days, 2 weeks, a month, however long it takes, maybe is something that is easier for the North Korean people, because that's the problem. You know, if it was just North Korean Kim Jong-un and his family there, it's easy to fix. But you got all these people. What are they going to do? What's going to happen? And they're going to have to be deprogrammed, just like people coming out of a cult. And they're suddenly going to go to the nearest computer, and suddenly they're going to be able to access Google and Facebook and CNN and Fox News and the BBC and everything. And they're going to find out this, you know, it's, I guess, like the Truman Show with Jim Carrey, where he breaks outside the bubble. Well, it's not going to be as pleasurable as that. How are these people going to feel? They're going to figure out that they've been living lies for decades. And once they find all of this out, what are they going to want to do to Kim Jong-un if you are allowed to live in exile? They may once eventually figure out that why Kim Jong-un, if he wanted to go the assassination route. But in that time, however that's going to take, that's going to be a lot of work. That's going to be more work than the Red Cross and any other humanitarian organization has ever taken on, ever. So it may be that war is the only answer, where you take over one town at a time and you let the people know what's going on, the ones that don't take up arms and don't die. And you just start giving them a little bit by a little bit of a little bit about what's going on. That's what's so scary about this. You know, you start playing out these scenarios, and I've told you, it needs to happen. North Korea isn't going to be stuck with 1940s rocket technology forever. They can't hit anything, but I'd have to say eventually they're going to figure something out. You know, that's a discussion we also had about nuclear devices, and I told Dave, I don't know how serious, I know that Kim Jong-un talks about being a dangerous threat, but anybody can set off a nuclear device with a button within their own territory. Can you put one on top of a missile and get it to go off at the right time? And I don't think that the North Korea has that capability. There's nothing that I've seen. So they don't even have 1950s American military technology, because we could do that by that time back then. And so we're very, very fortunate that North Korea doesn't have it. But they're eventually going to get it. They're eventually going to. For political scientists and people who like to write books and papers and get recognition for all this, this is fascinating, fascinating history. It's great lessons in history, both politically and militarily. I think psychologically, looking into the mind of a dictator, controlling a country, all the people who are brainwashed and have no idea what's going on the outside world. It's fascinating stuff, but what makes it fascinating also makes it dangerous. Although I'm not sure it's serious right at this second. We'll just have to see. But I got to go. You can find me, EdwardDensel.com. You can find this show, technically, Tuesday through Saturday, 2 a.m. Eastern, on the Prime Channel on Red State Talk Radio.com. Find the program also at Podomatic and iTunes. Please find my other show, Missing Person Show Unfound, on Podomatic and iTunes as well. I'm on Twitter, Unfound Podcast, Twitter USA Podcast. I gotta go. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.